The Washington office functioned not only as a liaison to the White House and Congress and to industry associations such as the American Petroleum Institute, but also as a kind of embassy to deepen ExxonMobil's influence and connections in the foreign countries where it did the most business. International issues managers developed contacts with ambassadors and commercial representatives of foreign embassies. As this international group in the K Street office expanded, Robert Haynes, a West Point graduate and Vietnam veteran, handled Asian embassies. Sim Motes, a former State Department diplomat, handled Africa. And Oliver Zandona, a mobile career manager, watched the Middle East. They also worked the American bureaucracy, particularly the State Department and the National Security Council, to influence and understand U.S. policy. They maintained some contacts at the Central Intelligence Agency and other federal intelligence departments as well. The CIA ran a station in Houston, where oil industry executives who traveled globally occasionally stopped by for informal exchanges about leaders and events abroad. But in Washington, the corporation's lobbyists tried to keep their distance from Langley, site of the CIA's headquarters, for fear that host governments where the corporation produced oil might mistake ExxonMobil as some sort of wing of the spy agency. ExxonMobil relied mainly on lifelong career employees for much of its Washington lobbying. Lee Raymond kept the number of full-time lobbying staff relatively modest, partly to avoid attracting unfavorable attention from journalists or opponents in the environmental lobbies. Where possible, the corporation lobbied as part of an industry coalition, principally through the American Petroleum Institute. Yet Raymond maintained a strong core of ExxonMobil staff to work Capitol Hill, the White House, and regulatory agencies. Many of the corporation's employee lobbyists rotated into Washington from other corporate disciplines, with little or no prior experience of government affairs. "I think we did it in-house so we could get it done right," said Joseph A. Gillen, who worked on environmental issues in the office around the time of the Mobil merger. "Exxon's culture was, let's do it ourselves." The corporation did retain Washington law firms and outside lobbying shops as consultants, although relatively few during the first Bush term. But these hired guns dispensed advice to ExxonMobil on contracts and were not typically relied upon to deliver access. Some of the outside retainers were even forbidden from attending meetings with public officials. Some of the key outsiders on retainer, former oil-friendly senators such as Don Nichols of Oklahoma and J. Bennett Johnston of Louisiana, attended a weekly meeting at ExxonMobil's office to exchange intelligence and analysis about legislation, electoral politics, and energy issues. These meetings sometimes had an air of jockeying and showboating, as the lobbyists competed to show how much inside knowledge they possessed, and therefore how much value their retainer contracts generated for the oil corporation. The corporation spent heavily on its Washington operation, but the great majority of its costs involved salaries and benefits for career employees. In 2001, ExxonMobil spent $6 million on its lobbying operation, but only $300,000 on outsiders. The next year, it spent $8.3 million in total, but only another $300,000 on contractors. Rouse oversaw only one lobbyist to watch the entire House of Representatives, Jean O. Mitchell, a University of Florida graduate, a cheerful woman who briefed ExxonMobil's policy and tax PowerPoint slides with genuine enthusiasm. Her counterpart for lobbying the Senate, William Buford Lewis, was a balding specialist in gasoline and other transport fueling systems. Lobbyists and consultants newly hired at the office were instructed that ExxonMobil sought to avoid asking for specific favors, such as earmarks, on Capitol Hill. "We don't need the government's help," was the prevailing instruction. "We just want to know the rules of the road." The line used to indoctrinate new arrivals to the Washington office was that ExxonMobil did not want anything from the American government, but it did not want the government to do anything to the company either. Lee Raymond saw his Washington operation as being 180 degrees opposite from, say, General Electric, which ExxonMobil executives regarded as a Washington rent seeker, always trying to bend Congress and the administration to policies that would subsidize or enhance GE business divisions. When Raymond saw GE's celebrity chief executive Jack Welch, He did not hesitate to give him a hard time about his corporation's favor-seeking in Washington. In fact, Raymond was kidding himself. There were many favors, executive orders, lobbying meetings, and laws ExxonMobil sought and obtained from the American government, including diplomatic intervention in small wars abroad, that affected the oil corporation's operations. Yet the above-it-all slogans imparted to newcomers did reflect the corporation's aversion to backroom deal-making on legislation in Congress. ExxonMobil had long had a policy of refusing to give rides to members of Congress on its fleet of corporate jets. The advantage of advertising a policy of asking for no favors from members of Congress, Raymond explained, was that, when they come and ask us for favors, we can say no. The corporation's typical lobbying meeting on the Hill involved briefing, and then leaving behind pre-printed PowerPoint slides vetted in Irving. When ExxonMobil lobbyists looked for serious help, they more often turned to the executive branch discreetly.